I just happened to be a college graduate, I wanted to say, but of course I didn't, as it never works to get huffy in these situations. If I have to, I'll just take the nice elevator from Lou's floor, then change to the service elevator on 2. The service elevator is like riding in a cat food can. There were 2 men at the IHOP tonight. One was broken-hearted and did not give the other guy a chance to talk. His topic was getting over Beth. The relationship didn't fall apart, he said. It was torn apart. June 13th. We went to Betty's Lounge for a drink last night. It's never crowded, and when we arrived, there was only one customer. She looked like a grandmother and wore rimless glasses and a straw hat with fake flowers on it. The woman was drinking beer and playing pinball, fighting the machine but never calling it names. I was watching her when 3 other women came in, 2 of them wearing feed caps. The bartender singled out the one who was bareheaded, saying, "I'll close up shop before I'll ever sell to a nigger." And that's what you are, a white-faced nigger. All 3 women appeared to be drunk. 2 of them adjusted their caps, while the 3rd one said, "You can't talk to me that way, you son of a bitch and asshole." The bartender told her to leave. Apparently, she'd shot a friend of his named Doug, with whom he had once worked at an ice factory. He said he would not serve any bitch that would shoot a man in the back with his own fucking gun. Shoot him while he was shaving, no less. How many years did you get, bitch? "Your mom is a fucking bitch," the woman said. The bartender lit a cigarette and threw the burning match on her. Then the woman started to cry. She said that Doug deserved to die and asked how the bartender would like it if someone pushed his head through the basement window and kicked his ass up and down Magnolia Avenue. The bartender said she deserved it. "Why, you bald-headed, you white-haired bastard," the woman said. "I'll shoot you, too." "You ain't never going to get the chance to kill me, nigger, because I'm never going to turn my back on you," the bartender said. The woman stepped toward the door and called the man more names. She said she didn't want to stay in this dump anymore. "Come on, girls," she shouted. "Let's go down to the wooden nickel." But her friends didn't join her. They stayed. After she left, they ordered drinks and told the bartender that they had never liked that bitch in the first place. Never. June 14th. Geraldine Page died yesterday of a heart attack. I heard about it on the radio. She was one of my favorite actresses. I went to the beach at Montrose Harbor and sat on a towel for a while. People there barbecue and then dump their hot coals on the grass and drive away, leaving everything else behind. They throw garbage into the lake just to watch it float. Children swim in the shallow water and pull soiled Pampers up from the bottom. What I like about Montrose Beach is that all the loud music is in another language. Bad teenagers hang out in the alley behind our building, and whenever they see me on my bike, they call me Pee-wee, after Pee-wee Herman, because I have an old one-speed that cost $8. It gets on my nerves, but if I had a better bike, they'd just steal it. June 16th. I had an elaborate fantasy yesterday after the kids called me Pee-wee again. I kept thinking how great it would be to follow them home, buy their apartment buildings, and evict them. I don't know what I would do with the buildings after I bought them. I wasn't thinking that clearly. June 19th. I ran into Walt on the L this morning. He owes me $450 and said he was just going to call me the other day because Gail, his wife, is always saying, "We need to pay that David Sedaris." I don't actually hold anything against him. I miss Walt and Gail. Walt said that last week she got a profit-sharing check for $10,000. That was why he planned to call me, to pay me. He said he took the check to the bank but lost it along the way. It was physically big, he told me. I folded it in my top pocket, and wouldn't you know? He called the bank to cancel it, then he called New York for a replacement check, but the woman whose job it would be to write it was on vacation, wouldn't you know it? At around 5, I took the L home. A woman near me had a 3-year-old child on her lap, a girl, who looked at me and said, "Mommy, I hate that man." Hours later, walking up Leland, I heard someone running up behind me. It was a guy who lives in the halfway house next door. He is black and wore a long-sleeved shirt buttoned all the way to the neck. The man called me sir and asked how I was doing. All right, I said. He told me that he had a taste for a steak sandwich and asked me if I'd buy him one. You can't pull money out of your pocket on Leland Avenue. It's like ringing a bell. So I said no, and he ran across the street to ask a woman the same question. Later still, I saw two men sitting in a car in front of the halfway house. They had the door open and were listening to the radio. As I passed, one of them asked me for a cigarette. I don't smoke, I told them. Then I thought of the guy who wanted a steak sandwich, and of the little girl who hated me, and thought, what the hell? I handed the guy in the car one of my cigarettes, and he scowled at me and said, fucking liar. June 21st. I listened to a radio tribute to Arch Obler, the creator of Lights Out, a scary program that aired in the 30s. They interviewed him at his home in Studio City, and then they played a few of his radio dramas, starting with Catwife, about a woman who hangs out with her friends, drinking and gossiping. Her husband calls her a cat, and then she turns into one.
That's what you are, a cat. A big, white, heartless cat.
It was a 15-minute story dragged out to half an hour. Boris Karloff played the husband and would say, "You, Linda, are nothing but a cat. A cat, do you hear me? You remind me of a cat. When I think of you, a cat comes to mind, you cat, you. You belong in an alley with your friends, yowling and carrying on, cat." When Linda turns into a cat, Boris Karloff feels responsible. He tries to keep it a secret and murders two people who discover the truth. Then Linda claws his eyes out and he shoots himself by accident. June 22nd. When John Chocontes was growing up in Greece, he learned to play water polo and smoke. He told me that when kids misbehaved in class, the teacher would send them to the corner where they had to kneel on a pile of rocks. I like the kind of man John is. He watches things closely and then does nothing with the information. His English has improved since I met him 4 years ago, shortly before he had an aneurysm. The other night at a pizza restaurant, he played a game of picking out the 30 spies hidden in the landscape of his placemat. I couldn't even find one, but then he explained it. "Is not the whole thing," he told me. "It's only the heads of spies." July 11th. Last night I watched a made-for-TV movie called Consenting Adult. It was another of those programs about how people with station wagons solve problems. In this case, the problem was a son who turned out to be gay. Marlo Thomas played the mother, and after learning the truth, she pulled her car off the side of the road and wept. It was silly, and watching it, I wondered why such movies always concern the upper middle class. If they were a minority family, the show would be a situation comedy, and everyone would laugh it off. July 16th. I went to the library and passed a street musician who had a live weasel in his guitar case. It was on a leash and was taking a nap. There was a girl at school who had a weasel, though she called it a ferret. She said it was sweet and would burrow under the covers while she was sleeping. If there was a weasel in my house, I'd move. July 26th. When Steve was 6 years old, his family lived in Hollywood, and he appeared on the Pat Boone Show, which had a segment involving kids and the adorable things they sometimes come up with. He remembers saying, "a doctor or a fireman," but can no longer remember whether he was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up or who he wanted to sleep with. September 13th, Raleigh. Amy said loudly to Paul's girlfriend yesterday, "Hey, did that bleach ever work on your mustache?" They were in a crowded ladies' room, and everyone turned to look at Angie's upper lip. Later, she said to Mom in line at the grocery store, "It's great they gave you your license back so soon after that DWI. September 20th, Chicago. Before I left Raleigh, Mom walked the dog up the street and back. It's part of her exercise, and she went as far as the Andrews' old house where Melina peed in the driveway. Just then, a boy drove up and told my mother to get the fuck off his property. He called her a bitch and a cunt, so Mom returned home, dropped off the dog, and went back up the street, where she told the kid that he couldn't talk to her that way. "Yeah," he said, Well, how'd you like it if I shit in your driveway? Mom said Melina was only peeing, but peeing and shitting were the same to this kid. Again, he called her a bitch and ordered her off his property. Then he threatened to come to our house with his Doberman pincer. Do you have a Doberman pincer? Mom asked. He said no, but that he could just come alone and pee in our driveway. Mom said that it was good he didn't have a dog, and that she wouldn't put it past him to pee in our driveway. She told me this in the kitchen as she poured herself a drink. Then she made me promise not to tell Paul because he would make trouble, and as a result, Melina could wind up dead. I can't keep a secret to save my life. So she said that if I do tell him, she'll never help me out again. Help means money. My lips are sealed, which is a pity. Paul would have gotten inventive revenge. He's not the type to pour sugar in someone's gas tank. Rather, he'd steadily chip away at this boy and his family. He'd be patient, and just when they thought it was over, he'd start again. It would go on for years until they begged for mercy. That Mom felt safe telling me about it is a real shame. An embarrassment, really. November 2nd. I bought an old newspaper photo of a suicide note left by a man named Wilbur Wright, who hanged himself in the county jail. I can't go on, it reads. Life isn't worth anything without you. Forgive me, Bobby. I love you more than you'll ever know. May God watch over you and our baby, Bill. November 3rd. Those boys were on the street again tonight, three of them. They are 10, maybe 12 years old. One is chubby and wears glasses. Tonight they yelled, "Nerd! You prick!" I'd never have talked that way to a grown-up when I was their age. November 4th. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that read, "I love killing communists." The word love was replaced by a heart shape I'm guessing they'll put on the typewriter keyboard any day now, right beside the exclamation point. The bumper sticker was on a Ford Fairlane on Montrose Avenue. November 7th. I saw a family, a mother, father, and 10-year-old boy, walk down Leland Avenue today. It was raining, and when the mother told her son to put up the hood on his windbreaker, the boy said, "Aw, leave me alone. My fucking hair ain't wet." She responded sweetly, "Maybe not, but it will be." November 14th. Barbara went to clear the dishes off a table behind me at the IHOP tonight. A couple was sitting there, both in their 60s, and they started smoking the moment they'd finished. "Was everything all right with your meal?" Barbara asked. "No," the woman said. "No, it was not. The meat was all tough and the vegetables was cold." "Well, why didn't you say anything?" Barbara asked. And the woman said, "We was hungry." November 16th. Steve Lafreniere loaned me a few copies of a St. Louis newspaper called The Evening Whirl, which comes out daily and is completely devoted to black-on-black crime. Criminals are pictured on every page beneath headlines like "Fiend Sneaks In While Parents Are Asleep, Sodomizes Their Two Sons," and "Mean Pastor of Church Dates Two Brothers, 10 and 11, He's Caught." This man rapes two kids, and the paper calls him mean? It was revealed how the sex-mad faggot tagged one boy that he especially adored and wrecked him. He would tie him up by his hands and body and go to work on his victim like a greedy hog that had missed a meal. He caught the boy like a rooster running after a hen and dragged him into the office, and oh glory, what a session, oh my. There was a short article in one issue titled, "You Don't Know Who the Hell I Am, Do You? I'm Mr. Muckety Muck with a Big Buck. Mess with me and you'll have no luck." Another article is titled, "Andy Gray Said, I Am Freakish. I Love My Own Sex and I Like 'em Young. If They Yield to Me, I'll Give 'em Some Tongue. I Can't Help How I Was Born. I'm Gonna Have Fun and Live Right On." It says in the article that Mr. Gray snorted and cavorted with other men. This paper is not to be believed. An annual subscription costs $35. The ads are placed by lawyers, funeral homes, and bail bondsmen. November 17th. Police caught the guy responsible for smashing windows and painting swastikas outside Jewish businesses on Devon Avenue. He's out on bail now, and this morning's paper included a picture of him. What strikes me is that he has a very small mouth, smaller than a baby's, I mean, tiny. If you wanted him to suck your thumb, you'd have to grease it up first. The article says he belongs to a skinhead group and has tattoos, which is strange, I think, because Jews in concentration camps had shaved heads and tattoos. You'd think the anti-Semites would go for a different look. December 27th, Raleigh. Tiffany left this morning. Last night we sat around in the basement with company, and she told us that she often gets gas trapped in her neck. She pointed to a spot beneath her ear, saying, "It's right here." I never heard of such a thing. She spent most of her vacation on the telephone arguing with black men who are a mystery to us. Some we've met once or twice, but she never tells us the nature of their relationships. It's not normal to spend hours in your room crying over misunderstandings with people who are just friends. She left herself out of a lot this Christmas. Every night has ended with Amy, Gretchen, Paul, and me sitting on one bed or another and laughing until 4 in the morning. January 3rd, Chicago. It was cold when I returned to Chicago yesterday, 11 degrees. I took the bus into town and was surprised when the driver kicked someone off. It was a belligerent man who'd been arguing with him over what seemed to me like nothing. After a few minutes, the passengers started putting their 2 cents in, and not long afterward, the guy was thrown off. "I hope you freeze to death," the driver shouted after he'd closed the door. The first Chicago baby of 1988 was born a few minutes after midnight. A suburban limo service had promised a special ride to the child and its parents, and other businesses had made similar offers. On the news tonight, they showed the mother and father receiving a box of fine cigars and a dozen roses before getting into the back seat of a Rolls Royce. According to the reporter, the two are not married. Both are 16 years old and black and from the West Side. They looked very happy. January 6th. It is bitterly cold out tonight. I was on Irving Park Road, walking past Graceland Cemetery, on my way home from the IHOP when a van pulled over and the driver motioned to me. I ignored him, and he followed slowly behind me and honked. When the window came down, I saw that the guy was missing a few teeth and that he wasn't much older than me. He asked where I was going, and when I said home, he asked if he could do anything for me. That stretch of Irving is usually busy with prostitutes. If he thought that's what I was, then the rules have definitely changed since I left Chicago for the holidays. Here I was, wearing 2 coats, 2 hats, and glasses. I thought of accepting a ride, but said that I was fine walking. Get into a car with a stranger on that stretch of Irving, and you can't really complain should something awful happen. January 11th. I ran into Shirley on Broadway in Irving. She was my neighbor on Kyler, the only other native-born American in the building. Shirley wears an overcoat, a house dress, and slacks all at the same time. She has only one visible tooth, and it's on the bottom. I asked about Ray, the man she lived with, and she told me he'd passed away on August 30th of cancer or something. Ray was always drunk. He wore ski caps, like Shirley does, and women's glasses. "He died on me," was how she put it. She said that her brother had died on her, too. Then she laughed, like they were off somewhere, hiding together. January 13th. David G. was on Wilson Avenue, walking behind a large woman in a thin winter coat. The pawn shop hadn't shoveled their sidewalk, and there was only a narrow path in front of it, bordered by snow-covered ice. 2 Mexican girls were coming from the other direction, and just as they reached the start of the path, the large woman shouted, "Out of the way, bitches! This is my country!" January 14th. Last week on Montrose and Magnolia, I noticed a flyer for a missing cat named Brutus. And this afternoon, in a vacant lot, I think I found him, big and black with ragged ears. He was dead and frozen solid. I called the number on the flyer and told the woman who answered where she could find the body. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's Brutus, I said. She asked if the dead cat had nappy ears, and I said yes. What I didn't say was that I think the body had been kicked up and down the street. It was scuffed, and a lot of the fur had been worn away. The woman sounded very distressed on the phone. The poster mentioned a $100 reward, but I didn't bring it up, figuring it only applied if Brutus was returned alive. January 17th. There's a Weebolts not far away, so yesterday I ducked my head in. The store sells dress shirts for $6. They sell a line of denim jackets that have love and peace already written across the backs of them. One of the cashiers, a teenage boy, wore a Gucci sweatshirt and had a sketchy mustache. He was smoking, and when a customer stepped forward to pay, he laid the cigarette on the counter with the lit end hanging over the edge. When it fell to the floor, he sighed and stepped on it. Half the shelves in the store were empty, not because it's a popular place, but because no one restocked them. They're exhausted over at Weebolts. Like the Aldi grocery store further down Broadway, their motto is, "Leave us alone, let us smoke in peace for God's sake." Goldblatt's is even worse. All the mannequins in their front window are missing their fingers. January 27th. At the underground Jackson L stop, I came upon a group of three rappers. The song they were performing was about AIDS. A message to all fags, fairies, and dykes that they are history. They will die and everyone will be better for it. One rapper said in an aside that he hoped there wasn't anyone with that shit standing next to him. A big crowd had gathered to listen and they loved it. Everyone laughed and applauded. I received a letter from Susan Wheeler, who's in New York now, temping at a company that makes dental rinses. For Christmas, her mother gave her a beautifully wrapped empty box, three pairs of queen-size pantyhose that are way too big for her, and $32. January 28th. I called about a job writing for a young person's cable show. The receptionist answered, saying, "You've communication." Excuse me? It took me a while to realize he was saying youth communications. I eventually got through to the guy in charge, who told me that I didn't want the job. He said he just had two people walk out on him, and then I'd no doubt be the third. I said, all right, and hung up. February 3rd. I got a job at a place called J. Roberts Antique Warehouse. They had a help wanted ad for a wood stripper, so I went in and talked to the owner, who asked me some questions about furniture. I start next week on a trial basis for $6 an hour. February 10th. I started my job at J. Roberts and learned I'm replacing a guy who made $11 an hour. I was told this by Earl, who makes $15 an hour. I was hired to refinish furniture, but the first thing I did was shovel snow. Then I swept, moved dressers from place to place, and cleaned brass. While moving dressers, I saw a throne made out of horseshoes. Earl said that five refinishers have quit since December. "Don't tell Jay I told you," he said. February 11th. At the end of the day, Jay Roberts handed me a check and told me it just wasn't working out. Earlier at lunch, the furniture repairer, Lorenzo, asked where I live. I told him, and he asked if there were a lot of faggots in Uptown. There were three other people in the room, and they all laughed. Lorenzo said that faggots destroy everything because they're perverted and only look out for themselves. He said that they're selfish and don't devote themselves to family. I asked if he had children, and he said yes. Why else would he work 6 days a week? Before I went to Popeye's, I asked if anyone wanted anything, and Lorenzo told me to bring him a woman with big tits. He said that he had one last week who almost tore his dick off. That's how much family means to him. I will never walk down that block again. February 16th. Reasons to live. 1. Christmas. 2. The family beach trip. 3. Writing a published book. 4. Seeing my name in a magazine. 5. Watching C grow bald. 6. Ronnie Riedrich. 7. Seeing Amy on TV. 8. Other people's books. 9, outliving my enemies. 10, being interviewed by Terry Gross on Fresh Air. April 5th. At the IHOP, I sat behind a pregnant woman in her mid-20s and her companion, who was in her 70s and walked with a cane. The pregnant woman is expecting her baby on July 4th and said she's hoping Mike can get his shit together before then. He's a baby's father and also an actor. Right now, he's playing the part of someone named John Deering. Mike doesn't act, he becomes, the pregnant woman said. She told her friend that normally that's fine, but when he becomes John Deering, he freaks out that he's got a baby on the way. A few weeks ago, he moved out of their apartment. She goes over to his new place and uses the computer, but only when he's at rehearsal. The older woman lit a cigarette and said that in her opinion, Mike was being irresponsible. The pregnant woman sighed. I'm just hoping he gets his act together. Maybe after the play is finished. Yesterday on the radio, I heard a young woman address a few of the hardships she's faced since her husband walked out on her and her two young children. Because he disappeared, she's still married and thus ineligible for welfare in the state of Virginia. She's college educated, but the children are young and she can't leave them alone. When she tries to get aid, the people at social services tell her that she's pretty, which means what exactly? That she could become a prostitute? Or find a wealthy boyfriend? She said that her 5-year-old got sick, and that when he sat on his potty seat, his intestines came out. I dropped my screwdriver when I heard that. April 29th. At the library, I got a biography of Dorothy Parker, and on the L, I dipped into the middle of it, where an old man reaches under the table for a lit cigarette. As he bends, his arthritic knees pop, and Parker stretches out her hand, saying, "Ah, there's nothing I love more than a good crackling fire." May 8th. They hired a waiter at the IHOP, a guy named Jace. He was okay at first, but now he brings in a portable TV and sits at the work table, smoking cigarettes and watching it. He tells customers it might be a 20-minute wait before he can take their order, and one after another, they leave. Last night, there were 3 occupied tables. It was me, a couple, and a heavy man who waited for 15 minutes before getting up to complain. Later, at the cash register, Jace apologized for taking so long. "Sorry," he said, "but I was watching a bullfight." A bullfight? May 29th. I got so sick of being called Pee-wee that I bought a new bike with the money I earned painting for Jean. It's like the one I had in Raleigh, a Frankenstein bike made of different bits and pieces. The brakes are new and the pedals. It's been painted umpteen times and there's a Playboy insignia on it. June 7th. I checked the Oxford Book of Canadian Short Stories out of the library. One of the entries is titled, "The Day I Sat with Jesus on the Sun Deck and a Wind Came Up and Blew My Kimono Open and He Saw My Breasts." June 10th. The poet Elaine Ekwe was supposed to teach a writing class at the Art Institute this fall. Instead, she and her husband are moving to New York, so Jim phoned this afternoon and asked if I might be interested. It doesn't mean I'll get it, just that I've been invited to apply. Adrian started teaching a few months ago in Denver and wrote that it leaves you with a constant feeling of deceiving people, that you know nothing they don't or couldn't learn on their own if they cared to. June 13th. Frank, the super of the building I'm working in this week, is full of jokes. "Hey," he said, "how come Puerto Ricans don't pay with checks?" "Because they can't write that small with spray paint." Another joke was about a Polish man who, forced to shit in the woods, was advised to wipe himself with a dollar. In the end, he winds up with shit on his hands and 4 quarters up his ass. June 23rd. Frank told me that the metal disc on the floor beside the bathtub is a cover for the drain, and that when it clogs, you unclog it with a product called Clear Out. He then pulled down the neck of his T-shirt and showed me a 6 welts on his chest. "I opened a jug of it once, and it spattered, so be careful," he said. Next, he showed me a scar on his arm. Here he'd used Clear Out to remove an embarrassing tattoo. Now he has only one, a heart on his upper arm that reads, "I love Patty." I asked who Patty was, and he told me that she was his first wife. I asked if that made things difficult with his second wife, and he told me that Patty and her three kids all died in a house fire while they were still married in 1977. House fire sounds different than just regular fire for some reason. It sounds meaner, hotter. He has one daughter left and told me that since the fire, he has gained 250 pounds. June 27th. Someone shit on the floor of the foyer I'm working on. Luckily, Frank got to work before me, so I didn't have to clean it up. It's so sad to see human shit out of context. June 28th. I got the job teaching a writing workshop at the Art Institute, and I owe it all to Jim and to Evelyn, who typed up my resume. My class will meet on Thursdays at 1 o'clock, hopefully in the Fine Arts Building on Michigan Avenue, where we can sit around one big table. I love the rooms there, but not the lights, so maybe I can bring in lamps to make it more appealing. On Thursday, I need to fill out forms and order books. I can make people read things. I'm thinking I'll assign Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man is Hard to Find, Tobias Wolff's In the Garden of the North American Martyrs, and an anthology called Sudden Fiction, because everything in it is short and it'll make writing seem possible. They're all great books, but between now and the start of school, I have to figure out why they're great. As a teacher, I'll have faculty meetings and cocktail parties. I can hardly wait. It's only one class, but still I plan to buy a briefcase and play the part for all it's worth. Now I can refer to all the Art Institute teachers as my colleagues. Dad is super proud of me. July 4th. We took a cab home from the Hotel Belmont, and the driver scolded me several times. Hey, buddy, don't be crawling in my taxi. Then he got mad at me for running my fingers along the track where the window meets the top of the door. You're nervous, he said. I know you. You're going to ruin all the rubber up there with your nervous touching. See that no smoking sign back there? See how it's worried around the edges? Nervous people done that, too. Ronnie was catering a banquet where the guests were drunk and annoying. A man asked her if she was Italian, and when she told him yes, he said, I thought so. All Italian women have mustaches. I'd never noticed that Ronnie had a mustache, but still it upset her. When she got home, she told Blair, who said she'd probably feel a lot better after a shower and a shave. July 8th. I saw a man being handcuffed under the Sheridan L-stop. He'd been beating a woman who wore a tight red pantsuit with an image of a cat stitched on each leg and the word cat written above them. Her face was puffy from the blows, and she stood there threatening the handcuffed man, who tried to break free and kick her. Look at what you done now, he kept saying. July 10th. New American Writing published my story, Firestone, and sent me a check for $15. One of the things I bought with the money is a terrarium I saw at a yard sale. I was thinking I could put hermit crabs in it. I thought of a hamster as well, but they really stink up a room if you don't keep on top of them. July 15th. At the IHOP, a boy had an epileptic seizure. I'd never seen one, and didn't tonight either. I knew something was going on behind me, but didn't turn around to look until the boy was asleep on the floor. He was snoring, and his mother stood over his body while his sister ran to use the payphone. Firemen came, and then an ambulance. An EMT guy woke the kid up gently, saying, Terry? Hey, buddy. Hi, boy. Say, buddy, do you know what day this is? Do you realize you're at the International House of Pancakes? Do you? They put him on a stretcher and told him several times to relax. When they wheeled him by, I saw his face. He looked like someone had woken him up in the middle of the night and told him to get packed because it was time to move. He was black and very light-skinned. Do black people become pale? Why don't I know that? Last night, Gretchen wore high heels, and the minute we got home, she kicked them off, saying the sound was driving her crazy. I swore to myself I'd never have a roommate who wore shoes like this, she said. It's been nice having her here. Every day she goes to the beach to revive her tan, and every day men fuck with her. They call out concerning all the various parts of her they'd like to have access to. Men on bikes, on the street, on the train. I forget how much crap women have to put up with. Last night, When she was walking down Devon, a group of six boys called out, "Woo, baby, come here." She walks on. July 22nd. I've been working on a new story and have pages of IHOP notes spread before me that I can't read. One says, "Gamer Strayer." Oprah had a show about people who have forgiven the unforgivable. One girl forgave the fellow who stabbed her 20 times and then stabbed her father, a minister, to death. She had pleaded for a stay of execution, as had the man whose grandmother was stabbed to death by a gang of teenage girls. I remember when that case was all over the news, the grandmother who was murdered taught a Bible studies class. A woman on the panel forgave the man who killed her son while driving drunk on Christmas Eve. He is a frequent visitor at her home now. There were two other guests, a woman who would never forgive the man who raped and drowned her sister, and a black woman who was shot in the stomach by gang members who then molested her daughter. She said she could hear the girl crying out, and Oprah said, "Did you help her?" "No," the woman said, perhaps feeling put on the spot. "I was shot and bleeding profusely." She explained that she still has a bullet lodged in her kidney and doesn't see the sense in forgiving anybody. "Hate is what's kept me alive," she said. In today's paper, I read about a 6-year-old girl who was stabbed 17 times by her mother's cousin. He was looking for money, apparently. I'm always struck by how many times people get stabbed. It seems like it's never just once or twice. It must be one of those activities that, once you get started, you just can't stop. The girl lived, but according to her grandmother, after the stabbing, she developed a mean streak and is bossy now and picks fights. July 29th. The subject on Oprah was profound handicaps. Two of the guests were parents of a teenage boy who weighs only 36 pounds. He is blind and dumb and now has impaired hearing due to an ear infection. He doesn't have any thoughts that they are aware of, and he lives at home. The father explained that the government will only pay SSI if you make under $17,000 a year. He advocated for a national catastrophic health plan, and that was fine, but he wouldn't stop talking about it. He said his daughter has diabetes and that his other daughter almost had cancer. Again and again, he interrupted his fellow guests, and in time, I grew tired of him. In the middle of the show, Oprah brought out a 24-year-old man. She said, "Jimmy, here you are. You have no arms, you have no legs. What keeps you going?" Jimmy was optimistic and spoke about his life at the university where he studies child psychology. He kept saying that, the university. He said that his roommate in the dorm keeps the TV and radio and computer on the floor so that he can get to them. Jimmy's neck was thick and muscular. He wore a suit with the arms and legs pinned up. Another guest, a young woman, had all her limbs, but they were too small. She could walk, but needed crutches for long distances. Forks she could manage, and light loads. She said that she wanted to die, but didn't have the wherewithal to commit suicide. Jimmy said he just wanted to help people. Once, when he was talking, they identified him at the bottom of the screen, the way they often do on talk shows. Judy seeks revenge. Marco loves women. His read, "Jimmy, happy to be alive." A couple in the audience stood to talk about their 27-year-old son, who has the mental capacity of a newborn baby. The husband was handsome and in his late 50s with a West Side Chicago accent. "I ain't fed my boy in 20 years," he said. "I'm scared to." I think I'm the ideal viewer for a show like this. After watching, I felt so lucky, like it's a blessing just to be broke and have bad teeth. I worked in Linda's garage today, and at one point the kid who lives across the alley came over to me asking, "Are you a boy or a man?" July 31st. This afternoon I went to Montrose Beach, which was quiet and not nearly as packed as Foster. It rained yesterday, so the sand was hard. I'd been there for an hour, reading, when two men and three children moved near me. One of the men was missing his left hand. His arm was fine until a few inches above the wrist, where it tapered to a point. He sat on a blanket while the other guy took the kids into the water, all of them fully clothed, some with long pants on even. While they horsed around, the man with the one hand turned on an enormous radio. and tuned it to a master mix station where the songs are not sung so much as bleated, bleated and repeated. After a few minutes of this, a fellow in a tank top came over and asked that the music be turned down. The radio was so loud I couldn't hear the argument, but at the end of it, the one-handed man lowered the volume. When his friend came back, the one-handed man related what had happened. He made a fist with his good hand and held the other arm straight out like a lance. "I was just about to hit that asshole," he said. I told him, "This is a free country, isn't it? Isn't this a public beach?" The wet guy looked off toward the water, trying to pick out the person who told his friend to turn the music down. He said it was good to bring up the free country business. He'd have said the same thing. August 7th. Late last night, a group of drunk white boys ruined their car and three others just outside my window. The crash was loud. I was in the sunroom at the time, thinking of ways to make money. The windows were open, and I heard one boy say to the other, "Get going, asshole! Fucking leave! Drive, you fucker!" The guy behind the wheel tried to take off, but his car was too damaged. I called the police, and called them again after one of the boys ordered the two others to remove the license plates and the stickers. If you want the cops to come in Chicago, you really have to put the word gun in your sentence. I called a year ago and said it, and they were here within 2 minutes, three cars of disappointed police officers. The boys took off with the plates and stickers, and I went to the corner where a group of neighbors were gathered. It was 2 a.m., and I stood with the black bicycle thief, his friend, and a family of five with southern accents. The little girl was named April, and like everyone else in her group, she was barefoot. One of her teenage brothers had a big cross tattooed on his forearm. Then there was her mother and her grandmother, who said, "Them boys was drunk, I mean drunk." She reached for a cigarette, then called to her grandson, "Skeeter, you got my lighter?" When the cops finally came, the grandmother told them that the boys had been drunk and that she'd had a time of it earlier trying to keep everyone's prints off everything. By this morning, the drunk boy's trunk had been jimmied open and all four tires were gone. Once a car gets a flat in this neighborhood, it's considered abandoned and is stripped. August 12th. Amy made it into the Second City Touring Company. They chose 6 people out of 250. Nothing can keep her down. Amy's success means success for the whole family. I'm so proud I'm splitting open with it. She has something extra. Anyone can see it. August 15th. I listened to AM radio church shows while I worked yesterday. One preacher denounced feminine men. "Now when God took Eve out of Adam, he took all of her out," he said. "He didn't leave any behind. Then I see these men with the weak elbows and wrists dressing like women, and I say no to that." I've pretty much decided to take Neil to the vet tomorrow. She shit all over the house this weekend and then peed on the rug. She's 17, so I can't really write this off as a phase. Her shit is liquid. Food just goes in one end and comes out the other. August 16th. We took Neil to the vet today, and on the way there, she peed on me. She peed on my lap, and then she just sat there. She didn't even try to get away from the urine. She's being cremated now, and I'll get the ashes in a few days. I'd always expected her to die at home. The vet said that's what everyone wants. He examined her, her shrunken kidneys, her bad breath, which indicates severe digestive troubles, and asked if Neil had stopped being a pet. "Has she withdrawn?" I said yes. She quit cleaning herself 6 months ago, and from then it's gone from bad to worse. Now my life is post-Neil. August 20th, Emerald Isle. Names of beach houses I saw today. Clambaker, Crow's Nest, Dune Castle, C&C by the Sea upstairs, Skinny Dipper, God's Gift, Buck Stop Here, Captain's Country, Skipper's Chip, Sea Mist, Sea Shape, Pelican's Perch, Footprints, Duck Inn, Breezy Outlook, Tip Top, The Scotch Bonnet, Riptide, Beechnut, Lazy Sea, Summer Love. August 23rd. At the dinner table, Mom fed the dog a piece of steak off Dad's chair, and he called her a big dummy. He was wearing a pair of shorts that hadn't been washed in weeks, so I don't see what the big deal was. No one did but him. September 5th, Chicago. Tomorrow I go to school to have my ID picture taken. Teachers wear them on lanyards around their necks so they'll have something to fool with when they get nervous. 1 week from tomorrow I'll have my first class, and I'm still working on an outline. Tonight I remembered that I don't know anything about point of view or about anything, really. So far I've gotten along okay, but as the teacher you're kind of supposed to be on top of it. My greatest fear is having someone like N in my class, the editor of the school paper. He writes articles about the nuisance of cigarette smoke and City Hall's feelings about artist spaces. Were he in my class, he could easily point out my inadequacies. I can point them out too, of course, but I'm not the student, and I worry that in defending myself, I'll sound too desperate. September 6th. Tomorrow is the cocktail party for faculty, and today I found a $5 bill on the street. I'm thinking I'll spend it on magazines. One thing I'll buy is this week's New Yorker, which has a Joan Didion letter from Los Angeles in it. September 8th. Last month, Evelyn's electric bill was $345. Kim's was $109. Shirley's was $280. Mine was $35. September 9th. I came upon two evangelists on State Street this morning, both conservatively dressed white women in their late 30s. One handed out pamphlets while the other preached. "Oh, just look at that," she said into her microphone as a young woman walked by. "The way she's dressed, she's asking for it, begging to be raped. And when she is raped, she'll deserve every single minute of it and eventually burn in hell." It seemed harsh to me, her judgment. If the young woman had stopped to listen, would she have been redeemed? September 13th. I realized I was a teacher when I felt warm during class and got up to open the door. Later on, there was noise in the hallway, so I got up and shut it. Students can't open and close the door whenever they feel like it. For my first day, I wore a white linen shirt with a striped tie, black trousers, and my good shoes. At the start of the session, I had 9 students, then one dropped out, so now I have only 8. September 22nd. I played my class a taped speech given by a woman named Nancy Sipes. It's about selling Amway, and while my sister Amy and I think it's just the best thing ever, one of my students thought differently and dropped the course during our 15-minute break. Then I was down to 7, but luckily 2 more students added the class, so now I'm up to 9. September 24th. I started a small job for Malik, the Indian man at R.J. Paints, who has dark brown spots in both his eyes, not far from the pupils. All I'm doing is stripping a door. To make less mess, I took it off the hinges and carried it outside to his small backyard. I worked alone until 3 women in saris stepped out and took seats in lawn chairs. They'd ask me a question in English and then speak amongst themselves in a language I wasn't familiar with. One of the women told me that she studies chemistry at Northeastern and asked me if I was a student. I said no, I was a teacher. Then she said something to the other women in their language, and they all laughed. She asked how much I made teaching one class, and that drew even more laughter. One of the women, the oldest of the 3, was a card. Her friends doubled over at her wry observations. I worried I might ruin their afternoon in the sun with my harsh-smelling chemicals, but once it had been established that I made the least amount of money, I became invisible, and they carried on as if I weren't there. September 26th. This morning, Malik answered the door in what was either a pair of pajamas or an Indian about-the-house suit, a knee-length shirt with a Nehru collar, and a loose pair of matching trousers. His neck, face, and chest were blotched with powder. I couldn't tell if it was fresh or if he'd worn it to bed. In the afternoon, I met his 5-year-old son, who was very sweet and asked kind questions. At Mitchell's restaurant, Amy and I sat next to an insane woman who was missing her front teeth and who had shredded her napkins and placemat. The paper littered the floor around her, as did torn-up bits of pancake. She spoke in 3 distinct voices, one of them rough and deep like Linda Blair's in The Exorcist. After sitting for a while talking to herself, the woman got up and went to the bathroom. She was in there for a long time, and when Amy couldn't stand it any longer, she went to see what was going on. The door was locked, but she could still hear the woman on the other side, cursing in one voice and defending herself in another. 5 minutes later, she came out, pushed her bangs away from her face, and said to the waitress, "Sorry about the mess, love," in an English accent, as if she were Haley Mills and had just spilled a glass of wine. After she left, the manager said, "Go check the washroom. She walked out of here too happy." The waitress ignored him, so Amy went in and reported that there was water all over the floor. The John was packed with toilet paper, paper towels, and part of the Sun Times. All the soap had been bitten in half, and there were crumbs in the sink. September 27th. This afternoon, Professor Sedaris addressed a dead audience. Even S., the mother of two who answers questions with questions and is usually confrontational, said nothing. I drown in the silence. Then I babbled, hoping someone would maybe stick an oar in just to shut me up. "Sometimes that just happens," said Sandy, a fellow teacher, when I saw her in the office. "Jim says that maybe next semester I can teach two classes, but right now that sounds like a nightmare. It would make me eligible for health insurance, which I'll need after I slit my wrists. What did I do so wrong today?" October 1st. Charles Adams died 2 days ago. On Friday, I worked for Malik, who answered the door in a breezy skirt, shirtless, and with more splotches of baby powder on his body. His son, Zeeshan, kept me company as he was home from school with a cough. When his mother gave him medicine, she said, "Zeeshan, you got to take this because I hate people what cough." The boy described the medicine as ugly. His voice is raspy, and I like how reasonable his questions are. He's only 5, but told me he has 4 children, the oldest of which is 9 years old. I want this kid. If he were mine, though, he wouldn't be so charming. At 3 o'clock, Zeeshan's sister, Nadja, came in with 3 other girls, cousins from upstairs. Everyone was very excited because one of them had won a goldfish at school. If any of the children in my building got a goldfish, the excitement would come from watching it twist to its death on the gas burner, but these kids were genuinely innocent. It was like a first-grade primer, a chapter titled "The Goldfish Excitement." I return on Monday and look forward to it. October 3rd. At the departmental potluck, I kept my mouth pretty much shut, afraid that if I spoke, everyone would realize that I don't know what I'm talking about. Not that I didn't ask a few questions. A couple of teachers talked about throwing people out of their classes, troublemakers. Their talk made me realize the subtle ways I'm being taken advantage of by certain students. I've been looking for the criminal with the livid scar on his face, and all the while I've been getting my pockets picked. M, the independent study kid I picked up last week, is a liar and a poor student. I shouldn't have let her in after the 3rd week, and allowing it has marked me as a teacher chump. Teacher chumps get a reputation, as do easy teachers. Come next semester, your class is full of lazy people expecting just to coast along. October 5th. I've been taking great joy in grading papers. My evaluations are typed and, for me, startlingly honest. I read them over last night, and am frequently struck by how mature and wise they sound. A child raised in a violent sexual environment should know at least 3 different terms for a dog's balls, and thingamabobs is not one of them. I write what works and what doesn't. I don't want to embarrass anyone in class or tamp down discussion, so the notes are just for the students. Today, in my box, I got Jay's story. It ran 1.5 pages and was followed by a P.S. My typewriter ran out of ribbon and it's pretty late. Another student, C., gave me torn half pages that were written in the cafeteria, probably while he was having a conversation. Last week he seemed interested, but this week he comes to class without his book and just sits there looking mean and bored. October 24th. I met with a woman named Betty who owns a 3 flat on North Kenmore and would like to have one of the apartments painted. Someone started the job a few weeks ago but was fired for laziness. Asked to remove the hardware and spray it with gold paint, he left the hinges and doorknobs in place and spray-painted them anyway. It looks beautiful, much better than it would have if he'd followed directions. It's like the knobs are spreading good cheer to the comparatively sober white doors. October 29th. Two well-dressed, white-haired women at the IHOP tonight. I noticed their looks as they walked out, but before then there were just whiny voices at the table behind me. The pair divided the bill right down to the penny, each owed $3.77. Then they addressed the subject of the tip and decided they should leave 70 cents. Neither said, "Oh, what the hell, just make it a dollar." That's how tight they were. One of the women had injured her finger earlier in the day and was concerned regarding its treatment. This was the one named Lil. "I caught it in the door, but I'm holding up," she said. "Most people would have fainted, but not me." "Finger," the other woman said. "You're talking about a finger?" "I almost lost a nail," Lil said. "Don't talk to me about one finger," the other woman said. "I caught three of them in a car door once. Nikki slammed it, and it shut all the way. You could see stars," Lil said. "Three fingers and the door was completely shut," the woman repeated. "And they swelled up terribly and changed color from purple to blue to yellow." "Sure they did," Lil assured her. "Anyone else would have fainted. Nikki, for instance. She saw what she'd done, and suddenly all the color drained out of her face. She was standing there." "I love that raincoat," Lil said, changing the subject. "I live in this raincoat," the other woman said. "I live in mine, too," Lil said. "Now can you help me put it on? Because with this damaged finger, I'm useless." November 23rd. I've been a bad employee lately. I went to Betty's with a drug hangover and fell asleep on her floor. I had a terrible headache and woke up several hours later with a carpet burn on my face. January 5th, Chicago. I weighed myself this morning and tipped the scales at 146 pounds. Last April, I went on a diet and only weighed 141. Now look at me. At the IHOP tonight, I sat facing the rotisserie on which three chickens turned and dripped juices. Tonight, I'll just have a steak and some spinach. Then, tomorrow, I'll have less. January 9th, Raleigh. Last night, I wondered if other teachers get stoned at night. Can I be the only one? Classes start next week, and I'm not at all prepared. January 15th. I will never again drink at a party I am hosting. I will never again drink at a party I am hosting. I will never again drink at a party I am hosting. I drank at a party I was hosting. After four beers, I had three screwdrivers. Then I started taking bong hits. It was around then that things started spinning. I ate an apple yesterday and a tiny sandwich. There were 50 people here. I tried to sit down and watch my guests dance, but the sight of them made me nauseated, so I stumbled into my office and collapsed. On the other side of the door, I could hear John Smith, who was talking about playing Pictionary with a dull partner who didn't know who Henry James was. I listened and tried to get up. Then I decided it was better to just quietly slip away. January 17th, Chicago. Today was the first day of the new semester, and I'm teaching two classes. There are 20 students in the first one. I asked everyone to list the last three books they'd read. Answers included Jonathan Livingston Seagull and a Danielle Steele novel. And then I asked what they'd do were someone to give them each $500. One person said he'd get more tattoos. Many wanted sound systems, and three wanted plane tickets to warm places. Because there are so many students, it's easy getting them to talk. One person ate in class, and another said, "shit," way too many times. Before they left, I had them each write a few paragraphs explaining to me how they'd lost their feet. Something has changed, and now, when I look at my students, I see only people who are going to eat up my time. Meanwhile, my diet is working. I went down a belt notch and was comfortable. January 19th. This was the last day of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and on All Things Considered, they asked a variety of people how he had affected their lives. The person I most identified with said that after the past 8 years, she will never trust a Republican again. There were many people who cheered him, and a few who hated him in a personal way. One woman blamed Reagan for her parents' divorce. She was from a farm family and said that the stress brought on by the president's agricultural policies ruined the marriage, which, under previous administrations, had been happy. A Brooklyn man blamed Reagan for his AIDS, speaking almost as if he'd caught it from him. I hated